This series was made possible by the kind support of Wellington Management, one of the world's largest independent asset managers, focused on delivering long-term investment excellence for clients and their beneficiaries, as well as Nile Capital Group, a sector-focused, operationally-oriented private equity firm based in the Los Angeles area.
No, I'm not talking about racial difference. I'm talking about the race of life, right? If you think of just progress in general, everyone has the opportunity to run that race, everybody, right? And that outcome, as we know, is highly dependent upon skill, innate talent, who's around you to coach you, you know, and a hell of a lot of luck. But the difference is, how easy is it for you to get to the starting line? Now, some people get driven in their parents' Mercedes. Other people have to walk around the corner. And then there's a demographic of individuals who have to walk 20 miles barefoot in the cold, jumping over hurdles just to get to the start line. And that piece there is the adversity that most of these founders have to go through just to be in the room.
Our next guest has been both a founder and a venture capital investor. Find out why he believes the freedom to fail and a community to catch you if you do is so critical to allowing all founders to flourish. I'm Ethan Devitt, and welcome to this 50 Faces Focus series, in which we showcase a diverse group of founders and venture capital investors. I'm joined today by Izechi Britton, who is a founding member, principal, and CTO in residence at Impact X Capital, which invests in startups across Europe, the Middle East, and Africa. He previously was the co-founder of Neighbor, a financial well-being provider, where he was also chief technology officer. He is the co-founder and CEO of Code Untapped, a digital skills accelerator, which runs ideathons, innovation labs, coding workshops, and other events to give underrepresented and diverse technologists the opportunity to showcase what they can do. Welcome, Izechi. Thank you for joining me today.
Great to speak with you today.
Well, great. Well, you have experience both as a founder and as a venture capital investor. Let's talk about your journey to here. Where did it start, and did it take any surprising turns along the way?
Yeah, it's a great question. Well, I mean, I guess the first place you got to start is I grew up in Southeast London. I went to a school where the 5A to C pass grade was only 14%. So my journey to venture capital is quite unconventional, as it were. I think Diversity VC did some research a couple of years ago where they found that in the UK, less than 8% of VCs have operational experience and only 4% of VCs have technology experience, and something around the line of 4% of VCs are from a diverse background. And actually in Silicon Valley, the number one indicator of whether or not you'd be a VC would be if your parents were a VC. My parents were teachers. I went to a very poor school in Southeast London. So, you know, none of those indicators play in my favor. So I actually did computer science as a degree after having failed my A-levels and talked my way back into being able to retake them. Having done that, I actually managed to land myself an internship at Lehman Brothers, the investment bank, in a technology role, where I then managed to spend the next 5 years as a technology developer programming in Java and .NET in their credit derivatives risk and pricing technology team. Then after that, I spent 5 years in Switzerland. This was post the credit crunch crash that we had, or the financial crisis. I spent 5 years working in Switzerland for Credit Suisse in the equity derivatives risk and pricing technology products team. And then post that, I left Credit Suisse, came back to the UK, and co-founded a fintech called Neighbor, which was all around financial inclusion, really. We were building a product that integrated with employers' payroll systems and allowed us to provide more inclusive lending to UK-based employees because we were integrated into their payroll systems, and we were taking those payments through salary deduction. It meant we knew more about them. It meant we could lend to them more safely, and it meant we could lend more inclusively. And we started that company back in 2014. It was just the three co-founders. And that ended up being a multi-award winning startup. We raised something in the region of £200 million, which was astonishing for a team of three ethnically diverse founders. And we lent out about £170 million to UK-based employees. So that alone was a far cry from where I started in Lewisham. And then post that, I took a step away and decided to have a think about what it is I wanted to do next. And I ended up launching Code Untapped, which, as you rightly mentioned earlier, is a digital skills accelerator. And that was predominantly to help give underrepresented and diverse technologists a voice and give them the opportunity to showcase what they can do so that they can actually find meaningful employment and have the same kind of opportunities that I had, really. And then whilst doing that, I was approached by Eric Collins from ImpactX Capital to join the fund as a founding member and then a principal and then as well as their CTO in residence. So it's quite a meandering journey for me. And what's interesting, it's always been in five-year stints. So it was 5 years at Lehman, 5 years at Credit Suisse, 5 years building Neighbor. And now I'm on to my next 5 years. I'm about 2 years in. So we'll see what happens in 3 years' time.
Well, there's a lot of fascinating aspects of that, and we'll try to unpack them one by one. But I'm just going to start actually with the present at the current spot. So now you are a venture capital investor, and you're looking at other startups, like perhaps you yourself had started. So what are you looking for in a startup and a founder? And what assistance are you going to provide beyond capital to them?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And, you know, there's a couple of key things you have to unpack with that. One is, do you focus on the jockey? Do you focus on the horse, right? And us, we definitely focus on both, right? We want to see that there's a good product there. We want to see that you've got a clear understanding of what you're doing. You've got your product into the market, so you've been able to execute on a plan. We want to see that you've been able to get some form of traction. If it's a revenue-led product, then we want to see that you've got paying customers or you've signed some clients, whether it's paid pilots that have converted. If it's a consumer-focused product, then we want to see really good, strong engagement with your user base. And this is really to see that, you know, you've identified a space and you're starting to grow into it. And then that's the key thing when it comes to the product. And what we're looking for in that product space is the potential. Potential for that to grow to be a £100 million business. That's really what we want to see, because we're a venture capital fund. We're not a grant fund. We're not an Innovate UK. We're not giving away dilution-free equity grants. This is a venture capital fund that requires a return on its investment. It's just that we happen to focus on a mission, which is to support diverse founders. So then that last part becomes very important, which is the jockey. And that is the founders themselves, the team. Who's on that team? What's the makeup of it? Do their skills complement? Have they had any experience doing this before? And ultimately, you know, do they have the tenacity to make it through the journey? Because as much as you focus on the product, the company, the space, when things go wrong and they need to pivot, and they inevitably do with early stage startups, the first thing you look at is this the right team to survive this and pivot it and take it through to success? That's always where you go to. So that's the space we should really be starting. And for me, the thing you got to understand as a founder is that everyone says, you know, it's a marathon, not a sprint. But what no one tells you is that you're going to be sprinting the whole way. So you really need people who have that ability to get knocked down, get back up again, and keep pushing forwards.
That's such an interesting point there around tenacity and resilience. How do you detect that? Do you look at prior failures? Do you look at life experience? Do you sort of watch them as they pivot real time?
That's a fascinating one. And, you know, I think for me, that's one of the things that just comes as a default when you're looking at diverse founders. It's almost that tenacity through adversity. Most people from our kind of backgrounds have had to go through a lot of struggle to get to where they are. And I mentioned to you when we spoke before about the race. And this is, and I'm not talking about racial difference, I'm talking about the race of life, right? If you think of just progress in general, everyone has the opportunity to run that race, everybody, right? And that outcome, as we know, is highly dependent upon skill, innate talent, who's around you to coach you, you know, and a hell of a lot of luck. But the difference is, how easy is it for you to get to the starting line? Now, some people get driven in their parents' Mercedes. Other people have to walk around the corner. And then there's a demographic of individuals who have to walk 20 miles barefoot in the cold, jumping over hurdles just to get to the start line. And that piece there is the adversity that most of these founders have to go through just to be in the room, right? So you've almost got there by default. But then past that, it is a case of let's hear your story. Let's see what you've been through. Let's understand what challenges have you had to deal with and how did you deal with them? Did you just give up, right? Did you start again? Did you try something else? Did you pivot? And talk to me about the issues that your current business has experienced and how you pivoted through those. Because the reality is, if I hear a founder say to me, everything's plain sailing, we've never had an issue, there's no competition, you know, we've got this incredible product, we're first to market, and we're going to beat everyone. I'm like, well, I like the confidence, but I don't believe you. Now let's hear the truth. And if that is the truth, then you haven't done your research. So you can start to dig into these simple questions and just get a sense for the level of realism in what the founder is telling you and the level of adversity that they've overcome to get to where they are.
Very interesting. I suppose my next point would be, clearly you have set up, or you're working with Impact X in order to solve a problem. Even when these founders get to that race, to the start of the race, they may have had to endure a lot to get there. It's not the same race, is it, either? Because even at the outset, there are issues around the initial capital and the perhaps availability of capital to diverse founders. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, so exactly that. And unfortunately, even for us as Impact X, we have a really difficult problem, right? Because our fund, we're still building it. You know, we're targeting a £100 million fund, which seems quite large by UK standards, but by US standards is technically a micro VC. But even in my pipeline of diverse founders, I have over 1,000 companies in my pipeline. When I say a pipeline, I mean, these are companies that have reached out to us or we've reached out to. They've largely, you know, at least 600 or 700 of them have come through our website application form process, which we have. So we don't operate only on a warm introduction basis. We allow cold introductions. There's over £1 billion worth of fundraising demand in that pipeline. So ImpactX has only been around for 2 years. And if we closed our fund tomorrow, I could only fund 10% of the companies that have reached out to us today. That's not enough. And those are the companies that have been able to get to the point where they've built a product and started selling. So there's this huge backlog of companies out there, as founders who are just trying to get going and can't even get to that point where they can even attempt to be in that 90% that I can't fund. You see what I mean? Right? That is a massive gap that we have in that space. And this is where I mentioned to you at one point the rich uncle phenomenon starts to come in. Because what we're talking about here is that early stage funding that startups need just to get their product MVP, their first prototype to market, or to even test their product with their customers. And what tends to happen in other circles is they have this network of rich uncles, rich aunties, who can introduce them to their friends, introduce them to the head of trading at Goldman Sachs, introduce them to the head of risk for Credit Suisse, introduce them to head of buying for Arcadia. You know, I'm just naming organizations, but that's just part of their family network. They don't have to do the work to find those people. Don't get me wrong. And this is where, you know, the conversation starts to fall down a little bit, is that even if you have those connections, it's still hard to build a successful business. It's incredibly difficult, no matter how many connections you have, but at least they have that first step. And it's that first step that we struggle with within our diverse founders. How can they get that initial bit of funding? You hear the statement, well, you only need to raise £100,000, so do a friends and family round. Yeah, but that's fine if you have access to that through your friends and family. But if you live in Stratford and no one in your family has gone to university or is working in a high-paid job or has access to anywhere near that level of capital, that £100,000 may as well be £100 million because you're never going to be able to raise it. And that's a massive, massive issue. There's lots of ways we can talk about how we can solve for that. But ultimately, what you need to see within these communities is the ability to have not only that access to early stage capital, but access to early stage clients as well, because that client piece is absolutely critical. When we look at these companies, the key question we ask them is, can you sell? ultimately, this is the most important thing. And this is why so many diverse founders target direct to consumer, because they don't often have those connections into the businesses to be able to build B2B businesses. And yet direct to consumer companies are so hard to build, because you have to create brand, you have to create awareness, you have to create virality in your product. And that can be extremely difficult to do. So one of the things we love to see is a B2B business where you've got a couple of pilots, you've got a few that have converted, you've built a nice little sales team, and you're able to get the engine running. Yet there are some significant barriers to being able to do that, simply because they don't have that network of warm introductions into businesses. So this is a space that really needs support. And that needs to happen through external communities, through accelerators, incubators, and people like us being able to provide those kind of services to early stage startups.
And I think you made a point earlier when we talked about the stakes being different for diverse founders as well, and perhaps the stakes being higher when they're trying to raise capital at this stage, and that they don't have the same freedom to fail, perhaps, as other founders might have. Can you just expand on that a little?
Yeah, freedom to fail. So we talk a lot about social mobility in the UK, and that tends to focus on education and grammar schools in particular. Thing is, to me, social mobility is all about, are you able to make a life mistake and recover from it? And when I say a life mistake, let's have a look at what happens to a typical person in the UK. At age 10, 11, they have to start thinking about their GCSEs. Those GCSEs determine which A-levels they take. Those A-levels determine what degree they do. That degree determines what job they enter. And that job, by age 30, is very much going to determine their earning potential and their career pathway. Now, how can you find yourself at age 30 doing something which was predetermined by you at age 10, right? That is insane. That is ridiculous. And the problem is that exactly as we talked about in regards to the rich uncle phenomenon, you at age 10 has a dramatically different social network depending upon which social demographic you're from. And if you have that network of rich uncles coming into the house, people who work as traders, work as quants, work as bankers, work as lawyers, maybe entrepreneurs, they own factories, whatever it might be judges. You have this implicit network around you of advice that is being swirled around you constantly, and that helps you determine which direction you're going to take. If you don't have any of those things, your peers determine which direction you're going to take. You're on that conveyor belt from a very early age with no way to get off of it. And unfortunately, you hit that age 30, and now you decide, well, I would love to become an entrepreneur because I took the wrong choice. Maybe you don't even want to be an entrepreneur. You want to try a different career. But how do you do that? Because now you have to think about your Maslow's hierarchy of needs. You've got to pay your rent. You've got to buy your food. You've got to look after your kids. But you don't have that capital to be able to make that switch. And the UK's safety net from a welfare perspective does not protect you from doing that. So the only people who have that freedom to make a wrong decision at such an early age and then correct course are those who have that inbuilt family wealth that allows them to make that switch. I was lucky because we didn't have any family wealth. My parents were teachers. However, I was very into technology and chose a career pathway in tech, which ironically my parents weren't particularly keen on me doing, which led me into roles that actually meant they were quite well paid, and I was able to save up enough of my own money to give myself that freedom to fail. Not everyone has that good fortune, and that is a major issue. And again, this isn't about, you know, equality of outcome, ensuring that everyone has the same outcome, everyone makes the same amount of money. That's not it at all. But there is something inherently broken with our system whereby kids are being pushed down a route that means the stakes for them are so massive that if they make one wrong choice, they're stuck on a career path forever. So when I talk about that, the stakes are higher. They genuinely are. Because for a lot of these people, even if they do save up that cash to make that switch, that might be their only shot at doing it. That's their only chance. They have to get it right. Whereas again, if you have that, you know, the bank of mum and dad, and you can continuously make that change, that is genuine freedom to fail. So until we have that, we will never have real social mobility.
And that's an excellent point. And I'm going to use this to segue in a minute, though, to Code Untapped. But before that, I wanted to ask you just about the investors in your fund, say in ImpactX. Once given your focus on diverse founders, and you mentioned some of the different dynamics among that cohort, can an investor in your fund expect the same type of returns as they would in any other venture capital fund?
Yeah, absolutely. So the few statistics out there show demonstrably, A, that first-time fund managers return generally higher than more experienced fund managers. And that's there's various reasons for that. But one of the main factors actually is the size of the fund. Having a smaller fund means you have to go into earlier rounds, which means you see larger multiples. There's a greater chance of failure, but you see larger multiples when you do succeed. The other is that ethnically diverse fund managers, particularly female fund managers, actually outperform the market. So the statistics are all there that show that this is the way forward. Now let's couple that with the mission. When we look at what we're doing, we're investing in diverse founders, right? If we look at the UK market from a venture capital allocation perspective, 96% of funding has gone to white men, in particular white straight men from a very specific social background. That tends to be a red brick university, typically Cambridge, Oxford, maybe Imperial, right? And that's the background that you tend to see. So only 4% of capital is going to anyone who's not white, straight, and male. That shows a significant arbitrage opportunity because, let's be honest, we all believe in equal opportunities. And even if you don't, it seems a very big stretch to me to assume that the only people who are capable of building successful, high-growth businesses are white, straight men, right? And if that's the case, then what we actually have is a major opportunity because we have this huge pool of individuals who are being overlooked by existing funds. What that says, to be brutally honest, is that they're underpriced. And if you look at it from the cold, hard light of capitalism, what you have there is an underpriced asset class, which means if you get into that asset class, you can get in cheaply. You can get in and have some influence on the outcome, and you can see oversized returns. So when we go out there with our fund, absolutely, we are talking about having, you know, beating the expectations. We're talking about returning capital, just like you would see in any other capital, venture capital fund. We are absolutely not a charity, which can be quite challenging sometimes from the mission perspective, because a lot of founders do see us in that light. And having to remind them, no, guys, we're here to invest, and this is what we need to see, can be really difficult. But that's what we do. So absolutely, for any LPs who are interested in ImpactX, they shouldn't look at us as anything other than a venture capital fund that drives returns, but also has a social mission.
Absolutely. This double impact is just so important. Let's move now to talk about your work at Code Untapped, because obviously education and a strong training can be a very important safety net when it comes to having that freedom to fail and to grow in one's career. What work are you doing there, and how much progress have you seen in getting more people into this area?
So at Code Untapped, we started Code Untapped largely because one of the things I noticed was I would often give talks around being a diverse founder, about the founder's journey, about technology shattering the glass ceilings. And yet around me, when I was giving these talks, the only people who looked like me were serving drinks and canapes. And the thing is, technology is such a superpower. If you have the tech skills, you can build a product, you can put it in a Google Play Store or the App Store, you can host it globally, you have access to a global audience. And you can do this with a few keystrokes. That is unheard of, to be able to, and this isn't just content creation, this is building products and services that have a global reach. Anybody can do that with the right skills now. doesn't mean you'll be successful, but the opportunity, again, so the outcome isn't guaranteed, but the opportunity is there. And yet I wasn't seeing it. So when we launched Code Untapped, really, it was about trying to encourage more diverse technologists into the space, and where we found existing diverse technologists, giving them a voice so that they can find roles in, you know, real high growth companies. And largely what we do is a combination of innovation labs, which you can think of as idea hackathons, workshops, coding sessions, all sorts. And we do focus on trying to place people as well. But increasingly, where we get a lot of traction is around trying to do these innovation lab sessions with different organizations, and really about giving that diverse community the opportunity to showcase what they can do. But what's fascinating about it is what happens on the flip side, and it's that ability for these organizations to get firsthand exposure and experience to technologists of diverse backgrounds who they might not see in their day-to-day. So when we run an innovation lab, for example, and we've had to do these virtually for the last year or so, which has had its own challenges. But when we run an innovation lab, we will bring 30 to 40 people together from diverse communities. And then we'll bring members of the company in as coaches to work alongside the teams that we'll set up on the day. And then we'll have a pitching panel, which will be comprised of senior leadership from that company. And this creates a really interesting dynamic where you have these team members who are working directly alongside these individuals, coaching them. So they get some coaching experience. They get the opportunity to do things that they might not do in their day to day. But they also get to work alongside these incredibly talented and driven and diverse technologists. And they get to see them up close and personal and see what they can really do. But then at the end of the day, so does the leadership. We did a couple of events. Well, we've done an event with Vanquish Bank, and it was their CEO who was running the pitching panel. And not only did he get to see individuals, he got to call them out. So he got to name drop, name check them. So imagine that you attended this Code Untapped hackathon, and you've got the CEO of Vanquish Bank saying what an amazing job you have done. This is an opportunity to network, to connect, to get mentoring that most of these people will never, ever, ever get. And that is really what Code Untapped is about. It's that exposure, it's that opportunity, and it's that connecting communities with meaningful roles.
That is amazing work that you're doing there. Let's just take this now to go back to your personal journey. You mentioned the mentorship and the power of what you're doing now with new technologists coming up the ranks. Were there any key people in your career who influenced you, maybe caused it to change direction, or that you can mention in any other way?
Yeah, that's a really great question. You know, I think for me, my key influence is probably a good friend of my manager in my days at Lehman Brothers, a guy called Bhupesh Bohra. I think he's at Royal Bank of Canada now. Absolutely amazing guy and one of the best managers I've ever had the good fortune to work for. And, you know, one of the things I always think about, I read a paper once which was titled "What Would Picard Do?" And it's all about Jean-Luc Picard from Star Trek. And it was how Star Trek The Next Generation was very much a treatise on leadership and on great leadership, actually. And the whole article was about whenever you have a leadership challenge, think to yourself, what would Picard do in this situation? And I hadn't realized it at the time, but that's very much what I do. But I think about what would Bhupesh do, right? In this situation, what would Bhupesh do? And that is how I approach most of my challenges from a leadership perspective. So Bhupesh Bohra, absolutely one of my main mentors from that perspective. Other people, it's hard for me to say, there have been so many. And I try to take lessons from everyone that I meet, whether it's good or bad. There are people I've met who I personally would never want to work with again, but the lessons I learned from working with those individuals have been invaluable. Sometimes learning how not to do a thing is just as important as learning how to do a thing. The great thing about success is that it feels good, but it doesn't actually teach you anything other than keep doing this one thing. But you're not even sure what it was that was good about it. You just know that the outcome was positive. When things go wrong, you learn very, very quickly what doesn't work and what you shouldn't do again.
I love that though, because it's just like it's always sometimes our negative experiences on a holiday that we remember most. I think it's interesting to mention that the people you work with that you might never want to work with again, because undoubtedly you've taken something from that experience, either what not to do, as you said. So I think it's a very interesting point. You've mentioned some wisdom already there, but is there any other maybe word of wisdom or piece of advice or creed or motto you live by that you can share with us now?
Yeah, there's one thing Bhupesh always used to say to me, and it's something that's always stuck, has very much stuck with me ever since. And it was this. It said, always give people enough rope to hang themselves with, but be there to catch them if they fall. And what I took from that is really it's about delegation. Give people the responsibility and the authority to do what they can do, right? And let them feel the pressure, let them feel opportunity to succeed. And give them that sense of, you know, if this goes wrong, this is on me. But the reality is people make mistakes and people do fail. But when they do fail, be their safety net so that they can reach for the stars, right? They can try to climb that ladder. And if they fall, you're there to catch them. But at least they know that they have your support and that fall doesn't break them, right? And that's the most important thing. And unfortunately for us, too many of us get broken by the fall and don't have the opportunity to start again. It comes back to that whole, really, we're coming full circle on that whole ethos of the race and the rich uncle and social mobility. Because if the fall breaks you, your stakes are infinitely higher than someone who has a safety net, right? And there's some schools of thought that say, well, if you don't have a safety net, you try harder. And I'm like, yeah, but what happens if something completely out of your control knocks you off the ladder? And that's ridiculous. You lose very talented people through not giving them that safety net. So that is possibly the defining piece of advice that really shapes my entire outlook, if you think about it.
That's very interesting. I just have one follow-up on that point of failure. How much of it is cultural? Because it might be said that certain cultures, say in the US, maybe Israel, have, you know, maybe celebrate failure or they don't punish it in the same way, that it's encouraged as sort of the part of growth. Is there a kind of a UK or European phenomenon where that is not as encouraged?
I would say absolutely. I think in the UK, we're getting better at it, and it's been driven largely by the startup mentality. But there is still absolutely a punishment for failure, unless you're from a certain social demographic, in which case you always fail upwards. You know, we can talk about successive governments and the ways that they've approached things, but from a specific demographic, you fail down, you don't fail up. Right. And I think women have been particularly punished by this as well. And what you tend to see in any ethnic minority, the successes, well, that was luck. The failures, well, that was to be expected. Do you see what I mean? And that's a very, very real problem, because what then starts to happen is people are afraid to try. And again, what happens is you lose out on a whole demographic of your population. They're unable to fully participate and fully give themselves over to that creativity and entrepreneurial spirit, because, again, that fear of falling off that ladder is real, because most of them don't have a safety net. And you'd be insane to climb the ladder if you know for a fact that falling off of it is going to break you. So why would you try? You're going to take the safe option. You have to. You have no choice but to do that. And that's a very real problem, because what you start to see is all the creativity is driven from a very specific group of individuals. And unfortunately, they have a specific worldview and outlook and set of experiences which don't support everybody. So we need that ability to fail within these communities. But 100% in the UK, not only are certain demographics punished for it, but overall, it's not something that's celebrated. Whereas in the US, failure is very much seen as part of the learning curve, right? And my personal belief is that failure and the ability to look back retrospectively is the greatest superpower that humanity has. our ability to look back and learn on our lessons is what enables us to push things forwards. Without that ability to have a look and say, why did this go wrong? There's just no way to innovate and improve. It's what we do. So it needs to be celebrated. Obviously, you know, when people fail because of ridiculous decisions, you can't reward them for that because you were just careless, right? That wasn't trying. That was fraud, right? There's a difference between the two things. But where people have genuinely pushed forwards, tried to change the paradigm, and it hasn't been successful, they shouldn't be punished for it. They should be rewarded for it, but they should be supported in trying again.
So many complex issues there. I think any one of those issues could have its own podcast, probably. But thank you, Vinod, for shining a light on them. So my last question is there any advice you would give your younger self after your various five-year stints that we mentioned at the beginning? If you were to go back, perhaps, to that A-level student, is there anything you know now you wish you could tell him?
Yeah, I guess my biggest advice to my younger self would have been to really focus on continuing to build that social network, meet people, learn about different areas, and ultimately take control of your financial future. If there's one thing I wish I'd done when I was younger, was focus more on trying to generate passive streams of income for myself to support me as I grow and as I try different things. So whether it's in property, whether it's in stocks and shares, whether it's in pensions, just trying to, you know, build that barrier for yourself so that you have your own safety net.
Very strong advice. But again, it gets back to the point you made before. If that's not what your social circle is talking about and your rich uncle is advising you, are you supposed to just get that out of the air? I think that's part of the problem. So yeah. Yeah. Well, you mentioned a superpower about being able to look back and learn from failure. I think what you're doing is another superpower because you are expanding, I think, the network of role models that young underrepresented people can look to and can see that it's not just the successes, but it's also the failures and the trying again that actually matters. And thank you so much for coming here to share your many insights with us. It's been an inspiration.
Thank you. It's been an absolute pleasure.
I'm Ethan Devitt. Thank you for listening to the 50 Faces podcast. If you liked what you heard and would like to tune in to hear more inspiring investors and their personal journeys, please subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be construed as investment advice, and all views are personal and should not be attributed to the organizations and affiliations of the host or any guest.